This is Inman's Real Estate Radio, where we go behind the scenes with the industry's movers and shakers to learn what's next for real estate. For more insight, news, and analysis, visit Inman.com. Here's your host, Bernice Ross.
Welcome. I'm Bernice Ross, the CEO of RealEstateCoach.com, and I'm very happy to welcome Cleve Gaddis. He is the managing partner and broker of Gaddis Partners REMAX Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Cleve, welcome, and thank you for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
We have a great topic for our listeners today. It's called Get Your Clients to Stop Stalling and to Take Action. I love this topic because when we talk about objections, everybody talks about this, but I've never heard of anybody talk about the stall. So you run one of the top 10 teams in Georgia with $60 million in production. So let's get to how you handle those objections yourself. So I want to begin with a very specific kind of objection that we all face. It's the property-specific objections. There are different kinds of objections under property-specific, specifically feature objections like I need a larger yard. How do you handle that?
Well, thank you very much for bringing up that specific topic, because whether it's somebody saying I need a three-car garage or I want a larger kitchen or I want a larger yard or I need more closet space in the master bedroom, any objection that is property-specific, the way you will normally handle that is you will change the amount of information or you'll change the knowledge that that buyer has. And what I mean by that, well, if you've looked at three homes and they're giving you an objection specifically about the size of a yard, then one of the smartest things to do might be to get out and show them the other homes that meet the buyer's criteria, number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, whether or not it needs to have a basement, whether it has a two-car, three-car, one-car garage parking. Find out exactly what they're looking for. Show them the other inventory available in that price range, in that criteria, and sometimes the buyer will come to the conclusion on their own that what they had seen before, the property that they objected to the size of the yard, once they have more knowledge about the yards that are available in other properties that meet their criteria, they might very well decide the property they saw yesterday meets their needs just fine.
Now, another type of objection is the price objection. So when the buyer says, I think the price is too high, what do you do with that?
I generally want to understand, first and foremost, what they mean by that. So I know as an agent, I spend a lot of time out in the field working with buyers, and buyers will say, well, this price is too high. I'm just not going to pay that for it. And sometimes the buyer just means, look, it's listed at $350,000, and I'm not going to pay any more than $330,000 because I said I'm not going to pay any more than $330,000. When my dad bought his house, he got a good deal. When my brother bought his house, he got a good deal. When my neighbor bought his house, he got a good deal. I'm going to get a good deal. And sometimes they're just sort of, Bernice, drawing an artificial line in the sand, saying, I'm not going to cross that line. And I'm not saying I have any issue with the buyer saying they don't want to pay any more than X number of dollars for a house. But I want to understand what is the rationale behind that position. What are the reasons behind that position? So I might say, if a buyer said to me, I think the price is too high, I might say, well, okay, great. I understand exactly what you're saying. But can you give me some additional information? Are you saying that the price of this property is too high relative to recent comparable sales in the area in the last few months? Or are you saying that the amount of money you would be required to bring to closing and the amount of payment, principal, interest, taxes, and insurance that you pay on a monthly basis is too high? And then I would just wait and get some clarification from them. If, Bernice, they gave me the answer of, well, this is too expensive based on recent comparable sales in the neighborhood, I probably wouldn't be able to solve that objection right then and there because I would probably need to do some additional research. But if the average home in the neighborhood had sold for $114 a square foot and this one was a similar size but was priced at $107 a square foot, it's very difficult for that buyer to argue that the price is too high. Now, there might be another reason the buyer doesn't want to proceed with the purchase, and that's fine. By solving the first objection or stall, I might very well get him to give me another one, which, if you think about it, Bernice, might be the real reason in the first place.
Of course. So we want to get to what the underlying objection is. Now, you also use the number of months of inventory on the market to motivate the buyer to settle on the home they're looking for. you approach this a little bit differently. Most of us talk about 6 or 7 months of inventory as being a, you know, transitional market or a flat market under 6. You've got a seller's market over 7. You've got a buyer's market. Your approach is a little bit different. Could you say more about that, please?
Yeah, so here's what we use. Here's what I use. It doesn't make it right, because I'm sure that if you put all the economists, the real estate experts out there and said, hey, do you agree with Cleve? They would all uniformly say no. But I say that it is a seller's market when you have less than 4 months worth of inventory. And by that, I mean, when there's less than 4 months worth of inventory, buyers tend to have to learn to scramble, to compete, to get the deals. I say that when there is 4 or 5 months worth of inventory, that you have a balanced market, not leaning too much toward the seller, not leaning too much toward the buyer, kind of balanced. And I say when you have more than 5 months worth of inventory, or 6 months or more, then it is more a buyer's market. Now, there are some exceptions, Bernice, when you have a unique property, one of a kind. Hey, if we find it, we're not going to be able to buy anywhere else. Even when you're in a market that has more inventory that might be considered a buyer's market, you might be more seller-oriented. But I have found that those numbers tend to work in terms of better judging buyer's motivation to get the deal done. Less than 4 months worth of inventory, buyers are motivated. They've probably missed out on a house or two. 4 or 5 months starts to be a little balanced. They might be able to ask for a few things, and the seller might agree. More than 5 months worth of inventory, the buyer probably could even make multiple offers on multiple properties to see which seller is most motivated in order to get the deal done. So when the inventory is low, sometimes you've still got to let the buyer go through losing a house before they understand and get properly motivated. But it's not fair to the buyer to do that and to allow them to lose out on a property, when what you could do is run for them an absorption report. You could run a neighborhood analysis. So, Bernice, if you were going to buy a home, and let's say you're going to buy a home in a neighborhood called Creekside, and we went and saw the home, you decided you'd make an offer, what I would want to do is do a full analysis for you, let you understand what the recent comparables were, what they sold for, what the features were, how many days on the market, what the seller's contribution toward the buyer's closing costs were, if that's something you can find in your area. And then I'd want you to understand what type of market we're in. And if, for example, the inventory in Creekside only would take 1 or 2 months to sell based on the sales patterns in the past 12 months, I would want you as a buyer to understand that up front. And if the average home only took 7 or 8 days to get under contract in the last 6 or 8 months, I would like you to understand that as a buyer. I'm not saying that I can force you to change your behavior, but if I don't educate you as thoroughly as possible, then I'm not putting you in a position where you can be sure about the decisions you make, or as sure as you can possibly be. And when you think about it, there's really nothing black or white about real estate. It's all gray. I don't mean from a legal perspective, but, you know, how do you know if a seller is motivated? How do you know if a buyer is motivated? You can't look at them and tell. So you got to educate them the best you possibly can on the market. Give them a fighting chance to make the right decision, to be able to live in the house that basically sometimes is perfect for their family.
Cleve, I couldn't agree with you more. When we get an objection from the seller that the price is too low, you use something called a market effectiveness ratio to deal with it. Exactly what is it and how does it work?
So the market effectiveness ratio is applied more from a – Bernice, can you imagine going on a listing appointment today? And I'm not trying to turn this into an interview, me interviewing you, but can you imagine going on an appointment today in North Atlanta where everything, you know, sells like hotcakes, all the news you read in the newspapers and watch on television says that sellers list the property and they have bidding wars, and this is not unique to Atlanta, it's all over the place. Well, you know, there's a lot of pressure for on agents for sellers to reduce the fees and not necessarily be concerned with bringing a real true professional in with a full marketing program with a tool belt of everything that needs to be done to market a home. And as listing agents, prospective listing agents, we are doing our seller clients or our potential seller clients a real disservice to let them think that every single thing that goes on the market in their neighborhood sells within a matter of minutes. Because most of the time, that's not the case. Now, I'm not saying that that isn't the case and that's not a legitimate market situation in some areas, but in most cases, the market does not deal with all the inventory. So in Atlanta, In 2015, 65% of the listings that came on the market in 2015 were sold and closed in the first listing period, which means 35, one in three listings were not absorbed by the market in the first listing period. So if I came to your home, Bernice, and I'm like, hey, I mean, your choice is, do you want to have a 65% chance of making it work? Or in our particular case, our efficiency ratio was 94%. So do you want to have a 94% chance of selling your home in the first listing period or a 65%? And I'm not, by the way, I know that's puffery, and I know that just because I say mine's a 94 doesn't mean that I'm perfect and better than everybody else. But if those numbers are factual, you as a seller have the right, and you really, it's my obligation to make sure I educate you as much as possible so that you can have the best chances of being successful in today's market. Now, from a buying standpoint, if I looked at that same market, let's say we go back to our fake subdivision of Creekside, and I looked at the market and I realized that 30% or 40% of the houses that get listed in that neighborhood do not sell during their first listing period, then I need to make sure and explain that to my buyer, because my buyer might want to be, Bernice, based on that information, a little more aggressive with their offer. Because trust me, if 40% of the inventory that gets listed in a neighborhood is not selling during the first listing period, most of the people who live in that neighborhood understand it because they see the signs go up and come back down without a new family moving in. And because a seller is saying to themselves, I don't want to be in the group. I don't want to be in the 40% whose houses do not sell. They might be more motivated to be more flexible on terms, price, whatever it might be with your buyer.
You know, Cleve, the way I've always approached that is very similar, but it looks at it on a monthly basis. So even if you've got a market where 33% of the listings are selling every month, 67% won't sell this month. So you need to be in the top 33% in terms of value and price, Mr. and Mrs. Seller, in order for your property to sell this month.
Absolutely. Well, here's the key. Bernice, it doesn't matter. In my opinion, it doesn't matter if you address that situation your way or if you address that situation my way. But here's the problem, is a lot of real estate agents, even though they mean well, they just take whatever the seller thinks and they sort of let the seller believe that it's gospel, but it's not. The seller is perceiving the market only from one side and they don't really understand it anyway. And I'm not saying it's our responsibility to force our clients to make the right decisions, because it's not. It's their responsibility to make the decisions that work best for them. It's our responsibility to make sure they have all the facts on which to make the best decision possible. And that's sometimes where we fall down. New agent goes in, seller says, people are selling like hotcakes. I could list mine with any agent. It'd be sold in 4 or 5 days and blah, blah, blah. The agent tucks their tail between their legs, moves on to the next listing appointment. And what they should do is realize that contribution is the key to success in anything. And if you want to help people, you have to contribute to their situation. You can't tell them things about the market that are not true. You have to tell them things about the market that are true, but you need to be giving them the facts and figures so they can make the best decisions possible. To me, that's the key.
Absolutely. Okay, we've been talking about stalls. Could you elaborate on what a stall is versus an objection?
Well, I mean, to me, they're sort of the same thing. An objection is is typically more house-specific, more product-specific, and more time-specific. And meaning, you know, you're saying, hey, do you want to go ahead and make an offer on this home today? And you're with the wife who says, well, I need to talk to my husband. That could very well be an objection, a legitimate objection, or that could be a stall. So let's categorize the objections as more property and time-specific regarding a property. And let's talk about the stalls as, I'm not moving forward listing my home because it's the wrong time of year. So that is sort of a general objection to the entire market. That's an objection to the entire world when you think about it. And I look at that as more of a stall. So if you don't mind, we'll just sort of address that wrong time of year stall. It's not at all uncommon for a seller to say, well, I'm going to wait and I'm going to list my home in the spring when the market is a lot better. And a lot of times I see agents who don't do anything to overcome that stall. So what we try to do is we try to have an analysis of what percentage of the sales that get closed in the Metro Atlanta market close each and every month, 12 months a year. And when a potential seller who I'm talking to in September says, I don't want to list my home until January to take advantage of the better market, and you show them on a piece of paper that if we take the average year, we take the number of sales last year and we divide it by 12, then we can see each month should have 8.33% of the sales for the year. In the better months in Atlanta, they'll get up to 9, 10, 11% of the sales. The worst months, which would be January and February, you'll still have 5.5% to 7% of the sales. But last year, in December, 9% of the sales that closed for the year closed in the month of December. And when I show a seller, a potential seller, look, here's what happened in the market. And I'm not saying that I need to manipulate them negatively to list the home in the fall and winter so I can make more money. I'm saying when they tell me I should list next year because the market is better, if that is not the case, I need to make sure and educate them so they can make the best decisions. And we have a lot of people that will go ahead and put their home on the market before the holidays because there's less competition out there. And sometimes they say, I read something in one of the online real estate resources recently that talked about the savings that buyers get in the winter months, but it's not necessarily that case in that case in Atlanta. You might have a 0.75% or 1% difference in sales price, but sometimes those buyers that come out in November, December, January, and February, they are the most serious buyers of the year. Because I'll tell you right now, if my wife wanted me to go out and look at houses on Christmas Eve, we're buying a house.
I believe you have addressed the wrong time of the year objection. What do you do when somebody says, I can't find what I'm looking for?
You know, and I think that's closely associated too. I can't list my home until I find my new home. And this is from a buyer perspective, I assume you're mentioning. And when the market started to pick up, so remember 2012, 2013 when the market started to pick up. So 2011, we had inventory everywhere. I mean, inventory everywhere. But if you bought a home in 2011, Bernice, was it really guaranteed that you were in a positive market and that the values were going to go up? I think a lot of people out there were just as afraid the value would continue to go down. So one of the things that we know about a tight inventory market is that your choices are going to be less, but also your chances for having a negative financial outcome are less. So, Bernice, I've been buying homes to live in for the last, 26 years. And every single house that I was going to buy was always going to have a three-car garage. Would you like to guess how many three-car garages I've ever owned? None.
Okay.
None. Because what happens is you sort of describe the perfect home, but as you look, you realize that you have to settle for things in certain places. And what I think agents don't do a very good job of today is helping their clients understand some of the things you have to compromise on. So in a time when if I wanted to be able to have every choice in the world to find the perfect home, I'd almost have to be in a high inventory market, which means if I bought a home in the high inventory market, it might be worth less 2 years from now than it is today. And I don't know about you, but I'd rather have a two-car garage instead of a three-car garage. When I've always wanted a three-car garage, I'd rather have a two-car garage on a house that's going up in value than a three-car garage on one that's either staying flat or going down. So even though you don't have as many choices, generally the market can be used to motivate people to move on.
Now, Cleve, how do you handle the objection, well, I'm just going to wait until the market gets better?
Yeah, and it could be I'm just going to wait for anything, and it's really almost as we talked about when it comes to listing homes later in the year. Well, let me give you a specific example. We've got a lady in Northwest Atlanta. She was going to list her home for sale so she could get closer to work this time last year. I'm just going to wait. We talked to her again this year. I'm just going to wait. Now, in both cases, she decided that she wanted to wait. But what we did for her is we figured for her the exact cost of waiting. So last time she wanted to buy a $225,000 house. This time she wanted to buy a $225,000 house. So we showed her the inventory that was available when she wanted to buy last year and the inventory that's available to buy in the same price range this year. And Bernice, as you can imagine, the houses don't look the same 1 year to the next because this year, a $225,000 house used to be a $210,000 house or a $205,000 house. And we computed for her the cost, the financing difference. So if, for example, you just take a $225,000 house today and you say it's going to appreciate at 3.5% from this year to next year, then you can, not that she's going to spend more money, but if she wants the same house, she'll have to, and you can help her understand the dollars and cents and the total overall 30-year cost for purchasing that house and how much it's going to go up versus this year. Because it can very well be a $20,000 or $30,000 difference to wait a year. And people say, well, I want to wait a year to get in better financial situation. The odds are they're not going to save that $20,000 or $30,000 from this year to next year. So, I mean, certainly there are times when people should not move forward with a purchase. And I get that. And I'm not trying to say all people should. But when it makes sense for them to move forward, we need to give them all the facts and figures. And Bernice, I know you've probably seen this. I mean, agents, some agents, they just get like they're lost when you start talking about how much money to bring to closing and how much are you going to pay over time and what your total cost of payments. And I just encourage anybody to really learn and get comfortable with all of the numbers, because if you understand the numbers, you can help everybody look at different scenarios, you know, and make the best decisions for them.
I look at the cost of waiting in terms of how much your interest rates, if your interest rates go up by 1 point, you're going to pay over the life of that loan 25% of the loan amount extra with a 1% interest rate increase. So on a $100,000 loan, you would pay $25,000 additional interest over the course of that loan if rates go up by 1%. So I love the idea.
Isn't that huge?
Yeah, it's huge.
And in today's world, I mean, there's always, Bernice, always the possibility that interest rates are going up. Now, unfortunately, interest rates going up and, you know, mortgage interest rates are not necessarily tied to the federal funds rate, which everybody acts like they are, but eventually they've got to start going up. And so any buyer that waits to buy from this year to next year, you know, there is a good chance they're going to pay a higher interest rate. And because when you think about it, when I bought my first house, my interest rate was 8.75%, and I was glad to have it. And today, you know, people would think that was an atrocious rate, and it would triple the cost of buying a house.
So let's go after one more stall here. I can't afford to.
And so this really, you have to get into the specifics. So when somebody says they can't afford to, if it's on the buyer side, then you want to make sure that they're addressing, is it the amount of money they'll need to bring to closing, or is it the amount of money they'll have to pay each and every month? So when they're saying, I can't afford to buy this home, you need to get them to be very specific. Not so you can force them to buy a house that's not right for them, but so you can be very specific about their objections. So, husband and wife are out looking for houses. This one is $15,000 more than the other houses they're looking at. Hey, what do you think? Are you interested in possibly placing an offer on this home? Oh, goodness, we can't possibly afford to. A lot of times an agent would just take that and say, hey, they don't want to buy it. But I need to make sure they understand what the difference is in the cost. So if it's a person who's putting 10% down and it's a $15,000 difference in price, they're bringing $1,500 more to closing, give or take. And then if they're financing the difference, that gives you $13,500 left over to finance. And at today's interest rates, the cost are what, $450, $460 per month per $1,000? And I'm not saying that that additional $55 or $60 in payments, that they need to accept that as their, you know, obligation on a monthly basis, and they need to buy the house because I think it's the right thing. I think they deserve to know the numbers specifically. And if they're saying no to something, they at least need to have all of the knowledge to know exactly what they're saying no to. From a seller perspective, sellers, you know, hey, the buyer's offered this price. The buyer says, I need you to give me $4,500 in closing cost assistance. And the seller says, I can't afford to do that. Well, it's really not fair to let the seller make a decision on what they can and cannot afford to do until you spell everything out for them. So as part of our offer, receiving offers process, and as part of our negotiating back and forth, we run estimated net to sellers for them that shows them within a couple hundred dollars what they're going to walk away from closing with. And what I have found out is that a lot of times when a seller says, I can't afford to, you know, support the buyer with any closing costs, what they're really saying is, hey, I'm old school. Nobody ever paid any of my closing costs, and I'm not paying any of theirs. And what you got to do is you got to get them off that subject to the bottom line. Does the bottom line number work for you, or does it not? And the buyer needs some closing cost help, and the home is priced correctly. Maybe you could just go back with a little bit higher counteroffer and include the closing cost. Your bottom line would be the same. The buyer would never be wiser, and ultimately, when that buyer's asked for closing cost help, they're almost universally, when you think about it, financing those closing costs over a 30-year period. Not a smart use of a loan, in my opinion, but it's what a lot of people choose to do.
So, Clay, to wrap this up, what's your final takeaway for our listeners today?
Learn from every single experience you have with a buyer or a seller. For the first 10 years of my work life, I had the great fortune of working for Electrolux, the vacuum cleaner company. And I taught people to sell vacuum cleaners door to door. And in that business, if you're not able to overcome objections and recognize stalls and move people forward, first of all, you'll be eating cat food. And then after that, you'll be starving to death. So you have to make, you know, you show up at somebody's door, you're trying to sell them a $1,000 vacuum cleaner. You better have some reasons why they need to move forward. And so what I always recommend my salespeople do is to write down the objections and the stalls they receive on a daily basis. Just keep a journal. And then to, in another column to the left, to the right of that column where you're keeping up with the objections or the stalls, write down the most appropriate ways or the things that you've said that are most effective to move things forward. And what's kind of weird is you have to be willing to experiment and you have to be willing to say things that, forgive me, but kind of screw up the process in order to find things that really work well. And so after a while, if you keep that type of journal for 6 months or 9 months or a year, you'd be surprised what a solid arsenal you would have of weapons to solve objections and to overcome stalls and to move the process forward. So learn from every interaction you have with a seller or a buyer and don't be afraid to experiment. Now, I didn't say don't be afraid to be a jerk. Don't be a jerk. Just don't be afraid to experiment in how you try to overcome that objection or basically jump over the hurdle that's the stall.
I love the suggestion of keeping a journal and learning from that because sometimes you'll come up with a really great objection buster and then it's gone. So great suggestion.
They can't remember it. The next time the seller says something to them, same thing, they're going, And if we're going to be professional salespeople, we have to be professional salespeople, like a lawyer, like a doctor. Trust me, a lawyer makes an argument in court that wins, they're going to be making that argument again. Doctor tries a treatment that works on this particular illness, they're going to try it again. Salespeople just open their mouth and just let words start coming out. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. They're supposed to be very purposeful, very impactful, meaningful to clients on both sides. And, you know, we're supposed to contribute. We're supposed to be looking for contribution to make our clients, sellers, and buyers' lives better because they're involved with us.
Clay, this has been a terrific session that you've done for us today. We've been visiting with Clay Gaddis. He's the managing partner and broker of Gaddis Partners RE/MAX Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And we've been talking about how to get your clients to stop stalling and to take action. Clay, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Bernice Ross, and thank you for joining us for MN Real Estate Radio. Be sure to tune in next Thursday when we'll be back with the industry's movers and shakers to learn what's next for real estate. For more insight, news, and analysis, visit MN.com. Make it a great day.